We'll zone into the rain report for June 18th, 2010 in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is the Radio Amateur Information Network. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, with this week's rain report. Rain is now on Twitter. If you have a Twitter account, you can visit us by going to www.twitter.com/therainreport. In our first excerpt from the 2010 Amateur Radio and the Law Forum last week, ARRL Volunteer Counsel Jim O'Connell, W9WU, discussed the pitfalls of buying that new home with its often not-so-publicized CC&Rs, covenants, conditions, and restrictions. This week, from our second excerpt from that same forum, ARRL Volunteer Counsel and author Fred Hoppengarten, K1VR, passes along some advice on how to erect that antenna that you want in the face of threatened legal action by your local city fathers and mothers.
I'll give you your takeaway message at the start. Don't apply for a variance. The reason is that variances require things that you may not be able to prove, that it's related to a condition. The land, for example. Just to be brief on that, please don't apply for a variance, unless the fix is in advance, of course. The first bunch of slides is going to be success stories to make you feel better about life, so that you won't be carrying around that woe is me feeling as you leave here. Let's talk about Prescott, Arizona, where N7CW is facing a maximum height of 35 feet, or the distance to the nearest lot line, whichever is less. There's the permit that he got. Sometimes it's easy when you have a non-obvious antenna. This was not a non-obvious antenna, if you're fond of double negatives. He did make the lot line requirement. In Whately, Massachusetts, the bylaw said that no building or structure shall exceed a maximum height of 35 feet. That's a microflect 144 tower. His particular interest is in Skywarn, so he's moving a lot of data at 1.2 gigahertz. In Citrus County, Florida, they had this really odd bylaw. It was an exception to a cellular tower bylaw, and it said that it doesn't apply to amateur towers under 70 feet. Well, the problem is that that says that the cell bylaw doesn't apply to towers under 70, but it doesn't tell you what does apply. We decided to emphasize that what they were doing in the bylaw is just providing a little bit of extra protection for small antennas. And I loved characterizing 70 feet as small. But this is the building permit for one of his two 70-foot towers, and that's the building permit for his 120-foot tower. In West Lampeter Township, Pennsylvania, which is Lancaster, is a Civil War territory for you Pennsylvanians. The bylaw said that the maximum height, really, says a total height above ground of 75 feet. This wasn't good enough. There's the building permit for the 130-foot tower. In Putnam Township, Michigan, W8SS was applying, where the maximum height was really going to be 100 feet. Not good enough. This is not the world's tallest stripper pole. It is 195 feet tall, and if I'd managed, this is apparently version 2. I have the one, a photo now on version 3. I'm not going to touch this computer, which has the antennas on it, and the antennas are impressive. This is 195 feet. I'm just trying to tell you here that we laugh at firm, fixed, maximum, unvarying, and absolute heights. Do not apply for a variance. An absolute maximum is illegal. With the right lawyer working the project, I'll give you my phone number later, you can defeat one of those firm fixed maximums. And the reason we laugh at these firm fixed maximum absolute bylaws begins really in 1989, where in the, I like the ham version, the W6ERS versus Burlingame, California case, where in a wonderful footnote 5, and this is a circuit court case. For those of you who know something about the law, you should know that we have circuit. Remember your 7th grade civics class? We have circuits. The United States is divided up into a bunch of circuits. There's a problem with a circuit that covers South Carolina, but we can deal with that. But beginning with the Ninth Circuit, the footnote in this particular case says what you are reading on the screen, which is that ordinances which establish absolute limitations are facially inconsistent with PRB 1. In Evans versus Boulder, Colorado, there was a maximum height of 35 feet. The case says that absolute prohibition of antennas above 35 feet are invalid. In 1993, Brower, I don't know this guy's call sign. If somebody does, I'd like to know it. Versus Indian River. This is a state court. There was an absolute prohibition on cases above 70 feet. And again, the court said that flat prohibitions are not permitted. In Pentel versus the city of Mendota Heights, ably handled by K0QB, the case actually says, and you have to excerpt it a little bit to get the wording to understand what it says, courts may preempt a local ordinance that bans or imposes an unvarying height restriction. Remember all those words I used at the beginning? Absolute, unvarying. In 2001, N2NVH versus Saratoga Springs, New York. Is NJ1F in the room? He lives in that town. He's always calling me. You sure? You sure? The case says any city's zoning ordinance that banned or imposed an unvarying height restriction would be facially invalid.
You're listening to the words of Fred Hoppengarten, K1VR, ARRL volunteer counsel and author of Antenna Zoning for the Radio Amateur. Fred will conclude his presentation given at the 2010 Daytonhamvention Amateur Radio and the Law Forum in a moment. This is the RAIN Report, available for transmission on amateur radio repeaters from therainreport.com. We'll be right back.
In 2004, in a Superior Court case in the Massachusetts system, these things can come up in both state courts or federal courts. I urge you to go to federal court, citing the cases we've just been discussing. Pentel, Evans, and Palmer. In each of these cases, the courts held that local ordinances would be facially preempted if they set absolute and unvarying height restrictions without providing for a special use restriction, a provision rather. This is what it looks like when we go to file one of these things. This is K0KT, who's a professor of statistics at Iowa State University. He's actually filing two copies of a three-ring binder, each with 49 pages. And if you get really ambitious and you're fighting a really large case, we're talking about a lot of towers in Story County, Nevada, where we're presently in the Federal District Court of Nevada. There was a stop work order, so we had to undo some things and apply for some things, and it was complex. But basically, here's your building permit application. Then we wanted to show that he really needed these antennas, so we used a little bit of software with the help of N6BV and a format that I developed in conjunction with WX3B to do a needs analysis to show that 65 feet really wasn't going to do it. And then we did an attachment to the building permit application as well as an 80-page supplement. So these things sometimes do get weighed by the pound. We'll have an outcome sometime this year. But let me tell you what goes into one of these applications. We cover such topics as why ham radio is different from cellular telephone, why amateur radio is a permitted accessory use everywhere in the United States and on every piece of property, why the particular ham needs it, that's the needs analysis. Then we go on to reassure the building department that it's going to be safe, that we are not exceeding the maximum permissible exposure, RF exposure, by including some calculations. By the way, in case you didn't know it, you're required to do those calculations anyway. And if you don't know how to do them, the ARRL has a book available for sale today by Ed Hare on RF. Then we talk about RF interference cases to show them that they really don't have any authority in that area, no matter what they believe. It is not like polluting a stream. They have no authority. We actually discuss head-on the question of effect on property values, and it is completely benign. I haven't seen any proofs. I discuss this intensively in my book, and then we discuss the law of preemption and why PRB1 really is the law of the land. We answer other objections, including birds, lightning, whether or not airplanes will fall out of the sky. I normally include a cover sheet or a letter from the insurance broker that says, in the event that there should be property damage, it'll be covered by the standard homeowner's policy at no additional surcharge, which of course means that putting up all the ham radio antenna systems you want is, in fact, much safer than letting a teenager drive. I like to put in charts about distances to the neighbors because you don't want to be in an argument. He's 40 feet away. No, it's 400 feet, you idiot. We just put in the chart along with some aerial maps. If it's possible in a particular application, we discuss the good works of the individual in emergency communications. And again, we reassure people that the power density will be less than the maximum permissible exposure so that children in that county will have the normal complement of eyes, ears, and toes. How to do all of this is discussed in excruciating detail in my book, with a generic application in Microsoft Word on the accompanying CD. The original book came out in 2001, published by the American Radio Relay League. 3,000 copies have been sold. It is out of print. You can see it on Amazon.com for $900 used. The new one will be available to you for $49.95 in July through the ARRL and other booksellers. I had 12 that came off of digital press 40 hours ago, and I brought them with me to have at the Crown Plaza if somebody is desperate and wants to get going before the 6 weeks it's going to take to get these things off the high-volume press. There is a Kindle version, but you don't get the CD with the Kindle version, but it's only $9.95. The Kindle version is of the 2001 book. This will eventually wind up there, but it hasn't yet. Anyone who wants to learn a little bit more about some of the cases I've been describing can find them mentioned at antennazoning.com. There is, just to make sure that no one gets confused, there's the amateur radio version of the book. This is the uncorrected proof. There's a commercial version of the book that was done for the Society of Broadcast Engineers. Don't get them confused. This is $129 and 447 pages. This is if you own a cellular telephone company, an AM or FM broadcast station. This is amateur radio. If you're at Dayton, this is probably what you're interested in, unless you happen to have a commercial interest.
So do you have forms in there and copies of these applications?
All of the above. Absolutely, all the forms. If you want the coupon for the commercial book, just come and take one. That ends my talk. I just wanted to return to the initial thing. This is why we can smile at firm, fixed, unvarying, absolute, maximum heights. It can be done.
Fred Hoppengarten, K1VR, ARRL Volunteer Counsel and author of Antenna Zoning for the Radio Amateur, a revised version of which has finally been reprinted by the ARRL. Look for it beginning July. Hoppengarten delivered this talk during the Amateur Radio and the Law Forum at the 2010 Dayton Hamvention in suburban Dayton, Ohio. Now, before we leave you this week, some advice on what coax you may want to use if you're a new ham or if you're planning to operate Field Day June 26 and 27. We draw upon a letter that was published in the June 16 issue of Handy Ham World. It was voiced by Patrick Tice, WA0TDA, driving force behind Handy Hams and editor of the Handy Ham World e-zine.
Hey. What coax should I use? The repeaters I want to use are all just a bit too far away for me to work with an indoor antenna or a handheld radio. I want to install an outdoor antenna so that I can use several different VHF and UHF repeaters. Now, I already have a dual band 70 centimeter vertical antenna, but what kind of coax should I use? And I'm thinking about RG58 or RG8X because my cable run is going to be about 100 feet. So, what should I do? Answer. Since the repeaters you plan to work are probably located in different compass directions, your choice of a vertical antenna is a good one, as long as the repeaters are not so far away that you would need a directional antenna with more gain. The directional antenna usually means an extra investment in a rotator system, a considerable expense, and an additional accessory to maintain over the ensuing years. One thing you will not want to skimp on is your feed line, especially if it is to be used for VHF and UHF work, and when the feed line is going to be run for a considerable distance. A short run of RG8X under 25 feet is probably acceptable for VHF work. The problem with these thin, cheaper feed lines is that they lose quite a significant amount of signal, and that's both on receive and on transmit. And the savings in initial cost for the coax are quickly offset by the poor performance they introduce to your otherwise well-designed system. RG58 is such thin, fragile coax that it is a poor choice for anything but temporary use or short connecting cables used in test situations. It is very lossy and should not be used over long runs, even for HF operation. Its fragility means that it can easily break. So let's take a look at the loss for a typical VHF frequency, 146.52 MHz, for three common types of coax, all assuming a 100-foot run of cable. Starting with RG58, the power in is 100 watts. The power out is 34 watts. The total loss is 4.7 dB. Ouch, that hurts. Moving on to the more expensive and slightly more robust RG8X. Power in, 100 watts. Power out, 39 watts. Total loss is 4.1 dB. Still a pretty big ouch. And RG213. Power in, 100 watts. Power out, 55 watts. The total loss is now down to 2.6 dB. Well, that's more like it. As you can see, the unfortunate truth is that all of these cables do have significant loss, but the cheaper, smaller cables will end up turning most of your signal into heat. Only the RG213 even comes close to being acceptable for VHF use with a 100-foot run. Now for something really scary. Let's try a 70-centimeter frequency, 446.0 megahertz, with the same cable run, 100 feet. Okay, the RG58, power in, 100 watts. Power out, you care to guess? Only 13 watts. The total loss is 8.9 dB. Double ouch. RG8X isn't much better. The power in is 100 watts. The power out, only 15 watts after 100 feet of coax. Total loss being 8.2 dB. Again, double ouch. And for RG213, the power in 100 watts, the power out after 100 feet 32 watts. The total loss is 5 dB. Well, still an ouch. We lost more than half of our power. 100 watts in, 32 watts out with the best of these three grades of coax, the RG213. Let's discuss this just a bit. Even with the best of these three coax types, you are still getting less than one-third of your signal to the antenna. Remember that it works the same way on receive. And why would you even bother with RG58 or RG8X for UHF work when 100 watts turns into only 15 watts or less? Long runs of cheap, lossy cable might just as well be dummy loads. As you can see from the results we have listed, the loss per distance unit of feed line goes up when the frequency goes up. Therefore, a cheaper grade of feed line might be acceptable for use on 3.9 MHz, 75 meter band, but far, far too lossy for use at VHF or UHF. Another consideration is that if one intends to use even higher transmit power levels, cheaper coax must not be used because it may arc over and fail. It is generally acceptable only for lower power levels. The results we listed are for SWR readings that are virtually perfect, 1-to-1. Since no antenna installation is actually perfect and minor mismatches occur in even a carefully designed system, the actual loss will be even higher than what we listed. This makes using good feed line even more important. So to summarize, you will have several important choices to make when you plan your VHF-UHF antenna system. You will want to decide which repeaters you want to work, their compass directions from your station, and whether you will need to choose a directional antenna or a vertical antenna. The supporting structure will add height, which is generally a good thing for effective VHF-UHF work, but also add to the length of the feed line, and longer feed line means more loss. If you want to try weak signal work on VHF and UHF, you will need a rotator and a horizontally polarized directional antenna. Unlike repeater operation, weak signal work on single sideband and CW absolutely, absolutely demands good quality feed line for the lowest loss possible. FM repeater operation is less demanding and will require vertical polarization. You may be able to make your horizontally polarized system work for repeaters, but your vertically polarized antenna will not be effective for weak signal work on single sideband and CW, so our recommendation is to use good quality feed line for every installation, avoiding higher loss coax except for short connectors and temporary use in short runs. Are you wondering how we calculated the loss for examples we used in this article? Well, it was easy with the online calculator that we found at the KC7HXC website. You can find it at KC7HXC.us. That call sign is Kilo Charlie 7 Hotel X-ray Charlie dot US. And you can link to that from your weekly e-letter. For Handy Ham World, I'm Pat Tice, WA0TDA at ARRL.net.
Audio courtesy of the Handy Ham World, and that concludes this edition of the Rain Report. Copyright 1990-2010. All rights are reserved. Now for Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, bidding you a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com. Go Six!